From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
I'm John Wells. Our first guest this morning, Dr. Chantel Pratt, who has written The Neuroscience of You. Pratt's book draws on decades of research. She writes, every brain is different, and what this means for the individual, the collective, and the future of neuroscience. We look forward to our conversation with Dr. Pratt. Our second guest this morning, Dr. Heidi Hamel, interdisciplinary scientist on the James Webb Space Telescope. The JWST launched Christmas morning 2021, and in short order, it found its position in the cosmos about a million miles from planet Earth between the moon and the sun. The craft successfully unfurled its shield, and for the last couple of months, it's been testing its complex instrumentation package. Lately, it's been sharing with the world the most jaw-dropping pictures of our universe that we have ever seen. We'll speak with Heidi about this remarkable instrument and what we have learned from its first pictures. These two guests, when we return, don't touch that dial. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. Our next guest is Dr. Chantel Pratt, who has written The Neuroscience of You. Pratt, a renowned researcher and University of Washington professor on the cutting edge of the brand new science that studies how individual brains work. She understands the brain is not just a complex organs being shared, but it's an organ that grows and changes dynamically every second based on circumstances. And no two brains are alike. Dr. Chantel Pratt, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. What a lineup. We're going to explore inner space and then outer space. That's so exciting. What a duo.
Well, we're delighted to have you on the program. Very much enjoyed your book. Maybe you can start off by telling us why you wrote this book and who you wrote the book for.
Oh, thank you. That's a great question. I wrote the book for people who want to understand themselves better, or anyone who's trying to understand someone who clearly works differently from them. I think we all intuitively know that we're not the same. You can be in the same room with somebody and come away with two totally different perspectives. And statements like, I'm not wired that way, show that people have an intuitive understanding that something about their way the brain works makes them them. But we haven't had the science or the language to really talk about it in a sophisticated way. And I'm just hoping to teach people more about themselves.
Yeah. So as you point out in the book, most neuroscience books, they say one size fits all. Here's the hippocampus, and here's what it does, and here's what this part of the brain does, and here's what happens when we do this or we do that. And what you are saying is that they are so individualized that you wanted to write a book that could help us understand our individual brains.
Yes, and certainly we have commonalities, you know, certainly the organ has all of the same parts and so forth and so on, but it's really, I would say, an artifact of the scientific paradigm that we only have this understanding that's kind of a sketch or a characterization. So we take groups of people and we put them into some device for recording their brain activity. And then we say brains work like this by describing the average. It's kind of like taking a room full of people and saying the average height in this room is 5'7". People are 5'7", when in fact, no person in that room might be 5'7". And then we come to say 5'7" is normal, which makes you feel like it's the ideal height. And I would argue that depends on whether you want to play basketball or take a long plane ride, whether 5'7" is a good height or not, right? So, you know, I have always wondered why two different brains doing the same thing activate different amounts of neurons in different regions, and that's as important to the science as watching a group of brains do two different things.
Yeah. Wow. I wanted to ask you, our show is targeting curious lay people, people that they're not necessarily scientists. Well, some are mathematicians and all of that, but it's for curious lay people. This book is also targeted towards curious lay people, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, my hairstylist, Katie, I call her my muse because she and I talk about the brain all the time. And, you know, she listens to podcasts. And I think this woman knows more about humanity than most psychologists because she sits and has conversations with people all day long. And I wanted to talk to people like Katie, who are just passionately curious and sort of armchair psychologists. We all are. We all study human behavior, whether we do it in the lab or in the real world, you know? And I wanted to give people an idea about this engine that drives our behavior.
Yeah. And if you hook me up to a whole bunch of sensors and I tried to quiet my brain, I understand that in less than 5 minutes, you can tell a lot from me just by checking the frequencies. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. So science is moving more toward characterizing a person. Well, not science, but I would say individual differences research. We're finding out that this kind of fingerprint of your way of thinking, feeling, and behaving is evident in your mind when you just relax and wander. Rather than giving you a particular task, which is really fun, and I have lots of those on my website, and using your behavior on that task or how your brain works when you do that task to characterize you, a lot of the really interesting things about you are still true when you're not doing that task, right? So traditional neuroscience takes the baseline of how your brain works and it subtracts that away from whatever your brain is doing when you do the task. It turns out that that baseline is really, really interesting. And the patterns of connectivity, the characteristic neural frequencies, the things I can observe in your brain when it gets to do whatever it wants to, are really important predictors of how you will perform in different circumstances, how you will learn, for instance.
In popular culture, there are books and there are movies about people doing mind control and reading other people's minds. So when we hear about an example of you having the ability to eavesdrop on our brains to understand the frequency that they are at a resting state and to be able to make inferences by doing that eavesdropping, it is a little unnerving a little bit to know that somebody can do that.
Absolutely. I totally understand that. And I will tell you that most neuroscience programs now have neuroethics and programs and people who are actually training and getting PhDs and understanding privacy from the brain standpoint. I think we need to think a lot about what it means and what we can do when we can eavesdrop on the brain. Because again, you know, I think that the identity is, you know, if your brain is not equal to you, it's a large part of whatever you think is you. And so if we can eavesdrop on that and or even influence it, we need to think a lot about ethics, consent, and privacy in that space. And it's certainly, you know, I'm happy that in the last 5 to 10 years, this field of neuroethics is advancing hand in hand with neuroscientists.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Dr. Chantel Pratt, who's written The Neuroscience of You. And if we start to understand and we grog that everybody's brain is different and there are so many things that make up the way, you know, our behavior is displayed, do you think that will possibly make us more compassionate, maybe open to others' opinions, maybe more tolerant of other opinions?
That is my ultimate goal. I think that understanding that the universe, you know, you guys are about to look into the universe is infinite and constantly changing. And your brain is this finite organ that takes snapshots of the universe and largely creates your reality. So that phenomena, the dress that took the internet by storm because people couldn't agree about whether it was blue and black or white and gold, really illustrates this. It illustrates two things. One is that different brains can come up with different interpretations of the same physical energy. And two is that the story your brain tells you is really convincing. You know, I've sat so many times with people pointing at the dress going, this is blue, this is blue, this is gold, this is gold. And if something as elementary as color, which we all learn has some relationship to wavelengths of light in the universe, if something as elementary as the color of an object is still largely open for interpretation in your brain, think about political views or beliefs or all of the different things that you believe that you know, and how many layers of interpretation go into that, and maybe feel just a little bit less confident about your perspective, or at least, like you said, grow an appreciation for what it means to have a different perspective. It's not just where that person's eyes are in the world, but it's that brain behind the eyes that's driving perspective, shaped by every experience in their life.
Yeah, I would like to see people having more of a conversation, a dialogue, rather than someone standing up on a soapbox and sort of beating their chest. And maybe learning more about this would allow us to say, you know, maybe I should learn a little bit more about this.
Yes, I 100% agree. I think ask yourself, where does your perspective come from? What data went into that interpretation? What are all the levels at which your brain has connected the dots? And then instead of thinking that someone behaving differently from you is making bad decisions or ignorant or angry or whatever stories we tell ourselves, ask yourself what kind of experiences and what kind of information processing in their brain, maybe a different value system, maybe more driven by moving away from bad things than moving toward good things. What about this person's brain could lead that behavior to be totally rational for them?
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about handedness a little bit. I'm left-handed. I use both hands in sports, sort of ambidextrous in a strange way, actually. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm in pretty good company with 10% of the other people on the planet that are left-handed. I was fascinated to find out that researchers don't use left-handed people in neuroscience testing or studying. Why is that?
I hope you mean fascinated and horrified, because I my daughter is also lefty, and
I feel left out.
Yeah, exactly. Lefties are left out, and you know, lefties pay tax dollars too, and lefties need surgery, and the why is that, you know, and I've sat on grant panels and the National Institute of Health, and this is by far the typical thing. I would say 99% of neuroscience research is on right-handed adults. And the justification is that left-handedness is more variable.
And again, that's a nice way of saying.
Yeah, left-handed brain. You can be left-handed for more different reasons than you can be right-handed, which I don't even think we have the data to support that. So again, like when you try and understand the collective and you throw 10% of lefties in there, and some of them, like my daughter, actually have reverse function. You know, so there, my daughter's language is larger on the right hemisphere than the left. If you average somebody who's got language on the left with somebody who's got language on the right, it looks like you have language nowhere, right? It's kind of like mm-hmm. a negative and a positive. So again, let's just not represent 10%. This is just a small thing, but it's huge, right? 1 in 10 people on the planet are not represented well in neuroscience. And the other thing I'll say is, you know, you mentioned being ambidextrous. Handedness is not a dichotomy. Handedness itself is not a one-size-fits-all thing. Handedness is a continuum. And in the book, I give people a lot of different ways of figuring out which hemisphere of their brain has a little bit more skill. And so you really, you know, there are tasks you can do on my website to figure out the actual difference between skills of your hands, or you can just ask yourself, like, how do I hold a broom? How do I open a box? How do I open a doorknob? Which foot do I put first when I go up a stair? You know, so there are a lot of different nuanced ways to figure out how balanced or lopsided your brain is and which hemisphere might have the slightly more skilled ability to control your body. And that gives us some insights onto other things that hemisphere might be doing.
My dad used to tell me that he knew right away that there was going to be a different way of looking at the world through me. When I got on a bicycle, I always pedaled backwards and I was left-handed. And he said, oh boy, but it's just kind of funny. But I'd like to know more about that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, you know, it was really cool because my daughter was 17 months old when I started doing neuroscience research. And, you know, I put her into a cap and recorded the electrical activity on her brain, and I'm learning how to analyze it. And I was like, well, I must have done something wrong. Like, this is completely backwards from quote unquote normal, which is the story that every textbook that I've ever seen in my entire life tells you. Language speech is in this one part of the brain in the left hemisphere, and comprehension is in this other part of the brain in the left hemisphere. And now, 25 years later, I've seen thousands of brains. And that's almost never the case in any individual, that these functions are localized to those specific areas. There's a lot of different areas working, and in many, many people, it's in both hemispheres of the brain. But this is just where the kind of commonality is when you don't include left-handers and you don't include people who speak a language other than English, and you're studying college undergraduates, and you erase every place where people are different and just look at the commonalities. It gives you a very rough picture. I mean, it's a great place to start, but it certainly doesn't talk about what makes you you.
And you mentioned your daughter and another person, and you as the experimenter, I believe were the first recorded instance of mind-to-mind communication. Can you talk about that test, when it was, and just talk about it a little bit?
I have done a brain-to-brain interface with my daughter. It was not the first. I was the, what I call affectionately, the puppeteer of the first, in which I connected my husband Andrea's brain to our colleague in computer science, Rajesh Rao. And what we did was use two existing pieces of technology in a new way. One that is used to do what's called brain computer interfacing, and this field has been developing for at least two decades, allows us to record the signals from someone's brain, make some kind of inference online about what they're thinking about, you know, with low levels of precision, depending on the tool. And then that decoder can then make something happen in a computer. And in our case, that something was to trigger a machine called transcranial magnetic stimulation that uses rapidly changing magnetic field to induce a small electrical current in the brain of the receiver. In this case, our sender was thinking about moving his hand. And when he did, our software could detect that, trigger this magnetic thing across campus, this magnetic tool, which was located over the motor cortex of my husband, Andrea. So when my colleague Rajesh thought about moving his hand, the result was that it would move Andrea's hand. At Cross Campus, they together collaborated to play a video game in which one person could see the screen, Rajesh, but he had no hands. Virtually, he had no hands. He couldn't interact with the software. The other person had hands, but couldn't see the screen, didn't know when to use them. And when we did this, it was really just, you know, there was The innovative part was creativity, really. We just stuck these two capabilities together, but we opened up the possibility of communicating, of sending signals from one brain to the other without any words, which is awesome. And a little bit creepy. I talk about that in the book.
Yeah. You know, you did a lot of research for this book. What most surprised you as you researched it?
I think the thing that most surprised me is that the concept of theory of mind, which means a lot of different things in different research contexts, but here I'm going to define it as our ability to reverse engineer somebody based on their observable behaviors, our ability to figure out what's going on in the mind of someone else based on cues like their facial expressions, et cetera. This ability to do this in an effortful cognitive way is zero genetically related. It's 100% related to environment. So this twin study was conducted on, I believe it was over 1,000 pair of five-year-old twins. They went into the homes of these twins and measured things like language ability, asked them a lot of questions, and did a lot of different experiments understanding how these five-year-olds could infer the thoughts of others. And it turns out that the genetically identical twins were no more similar to one another than fraternal twins, or twins that share, you know, on average 25% of their genes or 50% of their genes, suggesting that it's all environmental. And I think that this is so critical, because one of the things that we're learning from social neuroscience is that people tend to hang out with others whose brains work like theirs. I call it brains of a feather flock together, you know? So you were talking about what do we learn when somebody's mind is relaxed and at rest. Some researchers mapped an entire island in South Korea, created a social network based on people saying who they know, who they spend time with, and then took some large portion of these people into a scanner and just recorded brain connectivity when their minds were at rest. And they showed that you can predict who is going to be friends based on the patterns of brain connectivity, even after you control for things like age, gender, personality, how close they live to one another, like anything that you think would predict how well someone would be friends, how similar their brains were, explained variability even on top of that. And I think the reason for that is that if you're not consciously, effortfully modeling the mind of someone else, our instinctive way of understanding is through mirroring. So social creatures, even other primates, watch another animal behaving. Even when they discovered this, it was a monkey watching a human behave. They learned that we have these mirror neurons, and that when you observe an action, your brain sort of emulates that action. It activates the motor program that you would be doing if you acted in that way. And I think this kind of mirroring allows us to sort of feel pain or feel empathy when we see somebody going through something, but it seems to work better when that brain actually works like yours, right? So like if you're simulating what your brain would be doing, but that's not what their brain did, then I think you get misaligned. So having this fully learned ability to understand another is that it's exciting to me that we can, that it's teachable.
Yeah, I think you call it reverse engineering based on, for an example, the expression of their eyes. And you have a couple of examples in your book. You actually have some things that we can try in the book, which I tried. And as it turns out, I was pretty good at picking up, you know, that somebody was disappointed and the other person, and this other person was smiling or happy. But these are very subtle, nuanced things. Generally speaking, how good are we at reading expressions like that?
It varies. I mean, I think that's the point. Like, not everyone is good at it. People are dramatically different, and that ability to do the test that you did in the book it's called the mind and the eyes task, or the eyes test, to just figure out how someone is feeling based on only their eyes is strongly predictive of how well a team will function. Yeah. In fact, how well a team works is more related to that ability than to the collective intelligence of that team or to the maximal intelligence of that team. Being able to sort of pick up those cues and understand what might be driving them, you know, it's a really important skill, and it's one in which people vary dramatically.
Yeah, and some people just don't pick up on them. And I have friends who I believe are in that category, or one friend in particular. We only have a couple of minutes left, but one question I wanted to ask you is, of all the questions that you have out there on neuroscience, what one question would you want to have answered that has not been answered yet?
I would like to have a better understanding of the match between individual information processing and learning environments. I think we have these really naive understanding of people, you know, almost everyone will report being a visual learner or a tactile learner, but it turns out these things are more about preferences than they actually are about how well you learn when given information in one format or another. And I think everybody learns better when they can go and apply the information they've been given. But there are more nuanced things that differ between brains, such as rate of information processing, or whether people prefer to explore first and then understand why something works afterwards, versus being given, you know, instructions about how the thing works and then going to try it out. And I really think that we need to move away from this kind of narrow definition of what success looks like in a typical classroom environment toward really understanding the different kinds of environment in which brains maximally learn. So we're working on this in our lab in a very small way, looking at how people learn computer programming languages and what their brains can tell us about which parts of that or how they'll go about learning them. But I would love to see that move younger and younger and younger so that we're really maximizing the information we give our toddlers and young people trying to learn in school.
And you mentioned something in your book that makes sense to me, and that's that it's not winning a competition who's going to be able to play this game better, but it's understanding what lane you're in.
Exactly.
And I thought that just made sense to me.
It makes sense to me too. And I think that this is one of the tragic reasons why people can't talk about differences. We're so competitive and our idea of what winning means is so narrow, given the, you know, hundreds of millions of years that a vertebrate brain has been evolving. It's like, there are a lot of different ways that a brain can be successful. And I really think that the finding the lane model is the way to go with aptitude. Success equals finding the match between your brain and the environment that it's going to excel in.
Dr. Chantel Pratt has written The Neuroscience of You. We wish you continued success with the book, and thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much, John. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure. Thank you. And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We were just speaking with Dr. Chantel Pratt, who's written The Neuroscience of You. Our next guest was pre-taped 2 weeks ago on the day that the first James Webb photos were released to the world. Enjoy this interview. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Weir Peake. Last year, NASA and its partners launched the James Webb Space Telescope, the next generation of great space observatories. Now it has settled into orbit. It's fully functional. Its first observations have just been released. Here to talk about these amazing full-color images is expert Dr. Heidi Hamel, who's an interdisciplinary scientist on the James Webb Telescope Project. Dr. Hamel, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we are delighted to have you here. We've been following Webb for 5 or 6 years now. We've, of course, been doing shows on Hubble. We will be putting on Facebook and our own website all of the pictures that will accompany this interview. But for our listeners that have not seen the pictures, can you describe them to us?
Sure. There was a set of images that have been released, and the images targets were selected to demonstrate the capabilities of this amazing telescope. One of the first images that was released by President Biden, of all people, was an image of a very deep field. Now, it's not the deepest that JWST will ever see, because it's just a start, but it is still plenty deep. It's a piece of the sky where there is a cluster of galaxies. And this cluster of galaxies is so massive that it actually bends space-time. Now, we don't see the bending of the space-time, but we see the effect of that bending by the magnification of very, very distant galaxies all around that cluster. So when your listeners go and look at a picture of this deep field, they'll notice that there's, you know, some bright objects and stars, but they'll notice all these little arcs that sort of form a circular pattern. And that circular pattern is the effect of the gravitational lensing. And those little arcs that they see are actually incredibly distant galaxies that are so far away, they've been refocused by the foreground galaxies, and they allow us to probe all the way back very close to the beginning of the formation of the first galaxies in our universe, which is the goal of JWST. Its big goal is the first galaxies, maybe even the first stars. And that picture, that it demonstrated immediately that we're going to achieve that goal.
Yes. When I first looked at Hubble's deep field, and I believe that they were focused on this very small piece of the sky over a 2 week period versus the James Webb that was just focused on one day and came up with that incredible photograph. When I looked at that first picture, it looked like the galactic structure. It looks like the galaxies. They were very old galaxies, obviously, but they were slightly different looking. They didn't look like the galaxies that we have seen that are much closer to us. What were some of those differences, do you believe?
Now, you're exactly right that when you look at the more distant galaxies, which is looking further back in time, literally, the morphology does change and the color changes. Because of the expansion of the universe, the light from those galaxies is stretched. And when you stretch light, that means you're shifting it into redder wavelengths. So the colors all get redder. And also, the galaxies, when you get older, when you get further back in time, they go from being either these beautiful spirals or beautiful ellipticals to being more clumpy and blobby, weirdly shaped. And we think that that is evidence of the very earliest ways that galaxies formed, from the initial soup of material, hydrogen, that was sort of the first element that formed in the universe. Random clumps started forming, and then the clumps got close to one another, and those clumps clumped together to make these blobs. And it is only over millions of years that you start to get the more traditional galactic spiral shapes or elliptical shapes. So that's one of the keys of the science that JWST will do. It is actually going to be trying to track that galactic evolution over cosmic time and give us insight into the processes that made the galaxy the way it is today.
One of the challenges of infrared instrumentation packages is interference from other heat sources. And Hubble was sitting somewhere between 100 and 200 miles in orbit. There was all sorts of interference. Tell us why JW is different at the Lagrange point that it is, and what it does to be able to make its infrared instrumentation packages so much more efficient.
Yeah, so the JWST is a different kind of space telescope than we've ever launched before. Its design is to be optimized for the infrared wavelengths of light, because that's where we think the light for the most distant galaxies is. And so that means it's got a very different structure, with this big mirror that's out in outer space, completely exposed. And we also put it all the way out at the Sun-Earth-Lagrange 2 point, because we need it to be an extremely cold telescope, because the infrared light from the universe is heat. And if we had that telescope in a low Earth orbit like Hubble, the warmth of the Earth and the sun and the moon would really swamp the signals that we're trying to see. So we move it all the way out to L2, and then we built this gigantic sun shield as part of the telescope. It's really to put the telescope in the shadow of the sun, so we won't get any sunlight or Earth light or moonlight ever on it, to keep it super, super cold. So these are, this is a different way of building a space telescope than we've ever done before. It was driven by the requirement to be able to detect the coldest objects in the universe.
James Webb at the Lagrange point is able to balance itself between gravitational forces. Can you explain that, please?
Sure. We chose the Lagrange 2 point, Sun-Earth Lagrange 2 point, because it is a gravitationally stable point. And it's located about a million miles away from the Earth. If you imagine going from the Sun to the Earth and then keeping going in a straight line for a million miles, that's where this point in space is. And it's a place where the pull of Earth's gravity and the pull of the Sun's gravity is equal. And so when you put an object there, it tends to stay there. Now, we're not exactly at that point. We are in what's called a halo orbit around the L2 point. And so we are just in this tiny little orbit. Well, it's kind of a big orbit. It looks tiny from Earth, but it's orbiting the L2 point, because that is a place where we don't need to use very much fuel to keep this telescope where it needs to be. Gravity does the work for us. The gravity of the sun and the Earth keep it there. So it's a great place to have a telescope.
If you are just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Heidi Hamel. She's an interdisciplinary scientist on the James Webb Telescope. She is joining us from Sweden. Dr. Hamel, tell us what you're doing out there.
Yeah, I'm in Stockholm right now at a big conference, which is called the Hubble JWST Science Conference. And we actually had planned this conference for several years ago for the 30th anniversary of the launch of the Hubble Space Telescope. COVID delayed us for a couple of years, so we were now like at the 32nd anniversary of Hubble. But the timing was perfect because we've got JWST up now. And during this conference this week was when the first images from JWST came down. So this room filled with scientists who have been using Hubble for years and who have been planning to use JWST for years, we're all together seeing the first images, seeing the first reports from the various instrument teams. I can't express to you how exciting it is here. People are just, there's spontaneous applause and there's, you know, spontaneous cheers and all kinds of excitement right now here in Stockholm.
And I heard that the people have gotten emotional over this, that they've teared up. The pictures were so spectacular.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And you know, it's kind of a funny thing. They showed NASA has released not only pictures, but also spectra. This is like the intensity of objects as a function of color. And I will share with you that astronomers, they love the images, but the spectra, those are the real deep science. And when you put the spectra on the screen, like that's when people actually start to get really emotional. And there was a spectrum of a distant galaxy, redshift Z of 8 or more. And you could see actual molecular lines in this spectrum of this galaxy that is like almost further away than any other galaxy we've ever seen. And yet we're studying the chemistry of it with James Webb Space Telescope. That's a mind-blowing experience for a scientist. And so, it's not only the images, but all the data, every bit of data that we see has a unique story and makes the scientist really stand up and go, wow, look at that, wow. You know, my particular field of science is solar system science, and none of the planned early release data were from the solar system. There were more galaxies and nebulae and exploding stars and starbirth. But you know, just yesterday, we released our science report, the detailed, gory details of how all the instruments are working, and they included some engineering data, which included a picture of Jupiter. And I just look at them like, there's Jupiter, you know, and there's Europa, and there's the ring of Jupiter. And you could just see it in this 75 seconds worth of engineering time. There's this beautiful great red spot and beautiful Jupiter ring. And so, you know, what can I say? It's what a moment that we're on the cusp of just revealing all this information about the cosmos.
I wanted to ask you about your work because you have a lot of interests. And as you said, you study the solar system, the outer planets, their rings, their moons. You've used Gemini, Hubble, Keck, Spitzer, other space telescopes, Hubble, obviously, and now JW Webb. And I wanted to ask you, of all your interests, what one question would you like to see answered by James Webb that has not been answered yet? So what keeps you up at night?
You're asking me which of my children do I love the best? Is that
I am asking you that, Dr. Hamill.
So, you know, there's I have a couple of different ways of answering that question. One is that I, like anyone who's trained in astrophysics, I would be really excited if JWST were able to see the very first stars that form in our universe. Mm-hmm. That would be a breakthrough moment. It would change and pinpoint our models of how our universe came to be. And everything that happened since, right? Not only just then from the stars, the galaxies, and from the galaxies, the big structure, and then from the big structure, you know, we start to have stars and life itself. It's all part of the same story. And the first stars are a crucial part of that story that we haven't yet been able to detect. So that's pretty awesome, even though not my field. I'm still like, I'm with you. I'm like my cosmological buddies. I'm like, I'm with you. That would be amazing. In my own field of science, I think I personally got involved in the project years ago because I'm fascinated by the ice giants in our solar system, Uranus and Neptune. I study them with Voyager spacecraft. I've studied them with any telescope I can get my hands on. But we currently don't have any missions to them. There haven't been since Voyager, in 1986 for Uranus and 1989 for Neptune. That's my whole life, right? And So I joined the project so that I could ensure that this new technology telescope would be able to help me understand those objects. And we're going to do that. And I'm personally really looking forward to that observation. And I want to just mention one more thing. One of the programs that we're going to try is a little bit risky. And I don't mean risky in terms of danger to the telescope. I mean risky in terms that it might not pan out. Mm-hmm. But we're actually going to try to look at the plumes of water that are jetting out of the south pole of Saturn's moon Enceladus.
Sure.
And Jupiter's moon Europa, maybe. Mm-hmm. And it'll be a hard observation. And we don't know that those plumes are constant. And so all we can do is look and hope that we detect them. But if we do detect them and we use the incredible spectroscopic capability of JWST to measure chemistry in those watery plumes from these moons, that might give us insight into the watery oceans that we believe are below the ice, which may harbor life. And that if we detected chemistry that hinted at biological activity, that would be amazing. It'd be a game changer. And I'm not promising that we can. I'm saying we're going to try. And even if we find something intriguing, that won't be the end of the story. We will have to go there with spacecraft to do a more comprehensive study. But it could put us on a path to looking for life elsewhere in our solar system. And I think that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and we put a probe that had a sniffer on it that went through Enceladus's plumes, and they grabbed some data, but you're talking about grabbing a lot more data to really understand what's there.
That was just a little point, a little path through. Uh-huh. We can image broader areas. So could be potentially interesting. Could, hypothetical, maybe.
Dr. Hamill, there's always an element of the unknown. And Bill Nelson was with us right after he was confirmed a couple springs ago. And we had a really nice conversation with him. And he's a big fan, of course, of JWST. And he said that on this element of the unknown, there will be questions that we never even thought about asking before. And that's really intriguing to many of us, that this is going to be such a game changer that it's going to open up all sorts of questions that we haven't even thought of today.
The NASA administrator is exactly right about that. We have plans already for what we want to do with this brand new telescope, JWST. But those plans are predicated on what we know today and what we understand today. Then those are the questions that we're asking. One of the things that's so powerful about Webb is it's going to be opening new vistas to us in the field of infrared astronomy in particular. And we're going to be seeing things that don't align with our theories and our understanding. And that is where the science happens. When we find things that we hadn't expected, hadn't anticipated, hadn't planned for, and yet there they are in the data, that is when we learn. That is when our boundaries of knowledge truly expand. And to really have that expansion, these new questions, you need a tool that is more powerful than you've ever had before. And that's why our community of astronomers and astrophysicists and planetary scientists, that's why we're so excited about JWST. And the fact that it's working so well, we know we are going to discover things that we've never expected.
There are a lot of people that want to have particular shots taken or have particular areas of the universe explored. How do you manage all of that with people around the world, excuse me, that want to see a certain type of section of the universe?
Getting time to observe with JWST is a very competitive process, and that's true for all of our very large astrophysics tools, like the Hubble Space Telescope or the Keck Telescope or the VLT telescopes. So astronomers set up processes where periodically they will issue a call for proposals. And for our large space telescopes, that's typically once a year. And you know, there's a deadline, and you've got to have your proposal in before that deadline. And your proposal articulates what it is you think you can do with this telescope to look at the cosmos. You outline the science question, the observations that you plan to do, and how you think you can address your science question. For James Webb Space Telescope, there were over 1,000 proposals that came in for the first year of observations. And we have teams of experts who review those proposals. We do it in a way called dual anonymous, which means that the names of the people proposing are stripped from the proposals. So only the science, only the story of what is going to be observed and how, that's the only thing that's evaluated, not, you know, Joe Schmo went to MIT and is super, you know, famous, so we'll give him time. Doesn't work that way. Only your science question. Typically, you know, that, it's different for every telescope, but, you know, lots and lots of proposals are rejected. Yeah. At times, you know, 1 in 10 will be accepted, or 1 in 8 or 1 in 6. You know, it kind of depends on the particular year, how many proposals came in, how much time they asked for. But you can expect to be turned down. I will acknowledge that I have put in many proposals that have been rejected. I've been successful a couple of times too, and that's great. But you know, it's you don't always get the time you ask for. You have to have a really compelling case, because it's a very precious resource. You know, there's only so many minutes in an hour, and so many hours in a day, and so many days in a year. And you can do the math, and you know the number. And when we're super efficient, you know, we're just going from this observation to that observation to that observation, it takes time, and you can't do it all. So it's very competitive, but it's based on the science questions. You have to say, I can only do this observation with James Webb Space Telescope, and I need this much time, and I need to use this instrument, and then I'll answer this question. If that's deemed worthy by your peers, then you'll get the time.
And I want you to talk about our partners that have joined NASA to bring this extraordinary device to all of us. Tell us who those partners are, but also, is every picture, is every piece of data that JW picks up, is that going to be in the public domain?
Sure. Good questions, both. So our partners with NASA are the European Space Agency and the Canadian Space Agency. And both of those partners have made crucial contributions to JWST. In the case of the European Space Agency, they both contributed 1.5 instruments. The near-spec instrument is completely European, and the mid-infrared camera is half European. And so those are crucial tools, you know, for what we're going to do. And the European Space Agency also contributed the launch vehicle for James Webb, the Ariane 5 rocket on which it launched. And I have to acknowledge that the launch was so perfect, put it right on the right trajectory, that we didn't need to use some of the fuel that we had on board to, in case it wasn't perfect and we needed to do a little course correction. We didn't need to do that. And that means we have extra fuel left over, and we'll be able to extend the life of the mission beyond what we had planned as our nominal mission, which is kudos to Arianespace and ESA for that fabulous injection of our orbit. The Canadian Space Agency also provided a crucial instrument, the fine guidance sensor, and as well as the NIRIS instrument, another spectroscopic instrument. And this is the part that allows us to actually point and track on objects. Really super important part of the telescope. So this partnership is a really strong and important partnership. We couldn't have built JWST and have it be as successful as it currently is without ESA and without the Canadian Space Agency.
Sure.
Your second question was about what happens to the data. All the data from JWST goes into an archive at the Space Telescope Science Institute. The proposers who planned those observations typically have 1 year to analyze their data. And then after that, that data becomes fully public and anybody can log into the archive and download the data and start to work with it. Some programs actually waived that proprietary period. My program, studying the solar system with James Webb Space Telescope, I actually waived most of the proprietary time for all of my data. And my team members agreed to that. We did that because that way, as soon as the solar system data is in the archive, anybody in the community can download it, start working with it, and start thinking about what they might want to do in the future with JWST. I wanted to make sure everybody had the time to do that. Sure. And there are a couple of other programs called Early Release Science, ERS, Early Release Science. Those programs were actually designed to be first looks at certain kinds of things, exoplanets, star formation, deep universe. And those early release science programs also have zero proprietary time. They're designed to give the community the opportunity to see immediately what JWST can do in those various fields.
Okay. We, as a companion to this audio, we're going to be providing a number of pictures online. Where can our viewers go to keep current with this incredible journey?
Oh, that's a great question. Certainly NASA.gov. Mm-hmm. They will always have links to the great science coming out of JWST. And there's a public website as well that will be available. And you know what? I don't have it written down in front of me, so I can't tell you what it is.
Okay.
But you'll have to look it up for me. And so what I'll say is, I'm sure there's going to be a public website, just like we have for Hubble site, S-I-T-E. There will be a JWST website as well.
Sure. Okay. Very good. Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio, Dr. Heidi Hamel, an interdisciplinary scientist for the James Webb Telescope. And you have a whole bunch of other responsibilities too.
Yeah, absolutely. I keep busy.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.